Today is Monday, August 2nd, 2010. I'm Andrew Longhurst, and this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. Today we'll bring you a in-studio interview with Christine LeClaire, a BC organizer with Greenpeace, about the recent action at the Vancouver office of Enbridge, the Alberta-based oil company. We'll also be bringing you the latest edition of Groundwire, grassroots news produced by campus and community radio stations across Canada. This edition of Groundwire focuses on Indigenous perspectives and First Nations resistance. All of this right here on News 101, your source for independent news. But first, here are your headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Despite an EPA order to restrict the use of oil dispersants to rare cases only, the U.S. Coast Guard granted BP dozens of waivers allowing the toxic chemicals to be dumped on surface waters. According to U.S. Representative Edward Markey, the federal directive was issued in late May. Between then and July 19th, the Coast Guard gave the nod to 74 requests from BP, resulting in the spread of hundreds of thousands of gallons of the dispersants in Gulf of Mexico waters. The EPA's Dr. Paul Anasta announced results today from the agency's second round of dispersant tests.
Results also indicate that the dispersant oil mixtures are generally no more toxic to the test species than oil alone.
However, the oil dispersed by the chemicals is now spread through the water column. BP starts today on the two-pronged approach to finally sealing the well. The so-called static kill procedure will force heavy mud down into the well. The move will be followed in some days by a concrete seal at the bottom. Afghans calling for foreign forces to leave the country took to the streets over the weekend. This time, Afghan women were among the protesters. Bilal Jawad was there.
Hundreds protested against foreign troops on Sunday in Kabul, chanting deaths to the countries which interfere in the affairs of Afghanistan and killers of Afghans should leave Afghanistan. They demanded foreign forces quickly withdraw from Afghanistan.
My name is Sahar. We are obviously here condemning the occupation of Afghanistan by U.S. and the other foreign forces. The war of America is absolutely futile. The last 9 years have brought nothing for the people of Afghanistan but misfortune, killings, and shows the hypocrisy and dishonesty of USA and obviously the present government of Afghanistan.
The demonstration follows the deaths on Friday of four civilians whose car apparently pulled out in front of an armored vehicle belonging to an American embassy contractor. Demonstrators also decried the recent deaths of 52 civilians in Helmand province. Locals say the rocket was fired by foreign forces, but NATO's International Security Assistance Force, or ISAF, has rejected the casualty numbers. This is not the first time that people took to streets against foreign forces, but it is the first time that women participated, many carrying photos of dead civilians in their hands. Bilal Jawad, FSRN, Kabul.
More U.S. soldiers died in Afghanistan last month than in any other month in the nine-year-long war. 66 died in July, up from the second most deadly month, June. And yesterday, the Netherlands became the first of the NATO nations to withdraw their combat troops from Afghanistan. In Pakistan, the worst flooding in 80 years has killed more than 1,000 people and left some 1 million more in need of emergency aid. Doctors Without Borders reports that entire towns have been washed away. Tens of thousands of Afghan soldiers have been pulled from combat missions to aid in search and recovery. Islamic charities, who provided substantial aid during other natural disasters, are largely absent. Just after the League of Arab States gave a green light to direct peace talks between the Palestinian Authority and Israel, rocket fire from Gaza into nearby Israeli towns followed. Over the weekend, Israel responded with warplanes. FSRN's Rami El-Maghari reports.
Hamas says the Arab League's approval of direct talks between the PA and Israel would prompt Israel to further attack the Palestinian people. Hamas's statement came concurrent with a series of Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip over the weekend. The attacks killed senior Hamas resistance fighter Eis al-Batran. 13 other Gazans were wounded. Israel says the airstrikes came in response to a Grad-type rocket fired at the Israeli city of Ashkelon. The rocket fire left no human casualties, but did do some material damage. This weekend's violence is the worst since the January 2009 Israeli three-week war on the coastal territory, in which al-Batran's wife and five children were killed after an Israeli warplane hit the family house in the Al-Buraj refugee camp. On Sunday, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israel holds Hamas responsible for the increase in violence and threatened retaliation. Hamas has committed to unilateral ceasefires with Israel since January 2009, yet smaller factions continue to fire homemade rockets from Gaza. Rami El-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
UN Chief Ban Ki-moon says that Israel will cooperate with a UN investigation of the May attack on a humanitarian flotilla headed for Gaza. 9 people died. Both Turkey and Israel will have representatives on the panel, which will be led by the former Prime Minister of New Zealand and the outgoing President of Colombia, Alvaro Uribe. The House Ethics Committee said today it has found California's Maxine Waters in violation of House rules. Specifics of the charges were not made public. Waters is the second Democrat and second African-American to be charged for ethics infractions in recent weeks. Both she and Representative Charlie Rangel say they'll challenge the charges at a public hearing. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
And thanks to FSRN for providing us with those headlines. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver. And I'm joined in studio with Christine LeClaire. She's an activist with Greenpeace here in BC. And she's here in studio to talk about the recent action that took place this past Wednesday, July 28th, at the Enbridge offices here in Vancouver. Christine, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me.
So I want to start out by having you first talk about why Greenpeace is protesting a lot of the work that Enbridge is doing, and maybe if you could touch on a little history about Enbridge and sort of give us some context to the action that did occur.
Okay. Well, I guess the shortest way to say why Greenpeace went and occupied Enbridge's Vancouver office the other day is that Enbridge's poised to become BC's BP. And we really don't want to see what happened in the Gulf of Mexico happen here on the coast of BC. So the reason for that is because Enbridge is proposing to build twin pipelines that would go from the tar sands to Kitimat. One of them would transport tar sands oil to the coast, and the other would be transporting condensate used to dilute the tar sands oil from the coast to the tar sands. And that is problematic because pipelines are prone to bursting and leakage, as we recently saw just some days ago in southern Michigan. A pipeline leaked, I believe it's over 3 million liters of oil into a river that leads into the Kalamazoo, and cleanup efforts, from what I've seen, aren't going as well as people might have hoped. So with the pipelines running straight through BC, going over about 1,000 rivers and streams, the damage that would result in a spill would be quite severe, and those streams and rivers also include the Skeena and Fraser watersheds. So two important salmon rivers, we don't want to see those put at risk. And the other part of that, the risk that we don't want to take is the tanker traffic that would be coming through BC's water. So the pipeline's a problem in itself, but the tanker traffic that would be coming to collect the oil in Kitimat is a serious issue, because actually the waters up north are quite treacherous, and part of where the tankers would pass is where a BC ferry actually sunk in recent months. So it's not a question of if, you know, it's a question of when, and it's a risk we don't want to see taken with our coast. So
yeah, so a number of issues coming out of that.
Yeah,
clearly you don't buy the economic argument, though, that this is good for Canada, and what's good, you know, this is good for the tar sands, and what's good for the tar sands is good for Canada.
Well, I don't have a lot of attachment to that statement. I don't really, I could get in a lot of places, but I mean, people who are living along the coast are against the pipeline for obvious reasons that it would destroy their tourism and fishery industries. And there's also the thing that Enbridge sometimes brings up, which is that it would create jobs along the pipeline route. But those jobs aren't permanent. It would create a few, you know, jobs while the pipeline was being built. It would require, you know, bringing in specialized workers to complete the project. It wouldn't likely result in a huge amount of employment for BC workers. And people up north are talking about other ways of developing their economy that don't involve oil, so right. I think that's important to consider too.
Now let's talk about the action on Wednesday, July 28th. Now a number of Greenpeace activists essentially occupied an office and locked themselves to the office, and there was also a demonstration outside on the street at their downtown office here in Vancouver. Can you describe the scene that occurred both on the street and also at the Enbridge office?
Sure, yeah. Well, on the outside, and this is something I only got to see the next day because I was on the inside, and the installation was being set up as I was occupying the office on the sixth floor with three fellow activists. But on the ground, there was a cargo truck that was parked on the sidewalk, and a mock pipeline was installed over the cargo truck, and there was also an image of the Great Bear Rainforest installed in front of the truck. And now, from the truck was spewing molasses and water, but meant to look like oil, and basically, the idea was to show people that, you know, we don't want to take this risk with our coast. We don't want oil to end up all over our shores. We don't, you know, cleanups, they're just, they, what cleanup? You know, industry considers a 15% cleanup a success. And that, I mean, I can't call that a success by any means. So down on the ground, there were also folks dressed up as a cleanup crew, and one of my favorite lines that I heard out of that was that the cleanup crew was telling people that, you know, don't worry about it, just, you know, move along. It's just an oil spill, happens all the time, and there were also folks handing out pamphlets, so they spoke with thousands of people, raising awareness about the pipeline. And, you know, a lot of people didn't even realize there was a pipeline that was proposed up north. So that was great to raise some awareness that way. And as for inside, so there were four activists, as I mentioned. We basically just went up to the office, buzzed ourselves in, and We spoke with the receptionist to let her know that it was a nonviolent protest. We're here with Greenpeace and that we'd be there for a while. You know, we're planning to occupy the office to send Enbridge a very strong message that we do not want to see this proposal go through. And we're also asking them to withdraw their proposal.
Any response from anyone at Enbridge?
Well,
Anyone come out and talk with you?
Yeah, people who were in the office. There was one gentleman whose name I didn't get, but he was maybe there on a day off or had, I don't know what, but he was dressed somewhat casually, so he had some khaki shorts and a red button-up shirt, and he approached one of our activists and, you know, grabbed his arm, and I asked him to back away, let our activist do his job, and let him know that he was being filmed. So, you know, this gentleman stepped back and allowed our activists to proceed to lockdown. And then there was a camera crew and some media up there. So they were filming, you know, the lockdown as it happened. And then we played the waiting game. I mean, we had some company from security guards. We had a couple of visits from the police. We basically were there. We did some interviews while we were up there. But mostly we just waited.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what time did you start? What time in the day?
We started at 10 a.m.
Okay, and then what time, and this leads into the next question, a number of activists were arrested and charged. But how long were you there until police did lay those charges?
Sure. We were there for 14 hours.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how many were charged, and what were the charges?
All right.
And sort of what was the interaction once the police did arrive and notify people that they would be arrested?
Oh, sure. I should mention just before answering that question mm-hmm. that there were two activists down in the cargo truck.
Okay.
So there were two people locked in there, and they did actually stay for 24 hours. So one was our campaigner, Stephanie Goodwin, and another was an activist, Brian Beaudoui. And so they managed to actually stay for 24 hours, and they were not arrested and were not charged. But the four individuals, including myself, who were upstairs, were removed after 14 hours, and were charged with, three of us were charged with mischief and assault by trespass, and one was charged with mischief.
Okay.
Yeah.
And have you had your hearing yet?
I haven't, actually. That's going to take place in a couple of days.
Okay. And at that point, you'll either be, I guess, given a fine to pay or to bail?
Yeah, it's hard to say what will happen. That hearing, from my understanding, is more for the purpose of setting up a later hearing.
Okay.
So, yeah, so I think it's more of a scheduling thing that happens with this initial hearing.
Now, is this your first arrest as a Greenpeace activist?
No, it's not, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I was arrested last year in Kelowna, actually, at a Costco.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for protesting their sale of unsustainably harvested seafood. So.
Right. And just give me a sense of the folks, the Greenpeace folks that were there. Are many of them seasoned activists? Are they newer activists? Like, what's a typical
full spectrum
of folks?
Yeah. So there's folks who are regular volunteers, and it all depends on what kind of risk people are willing to take, right? So some folks, have more experience and are willing to put themselves at risk of arrest, like myself and the other folks I was with upstairs, and other people come mm-hmm. to it from different places and different levels of experience and
right.
yeah.
Now, how do you gauge the success of a demonstration and action like this? I mean, sometimes it can be hard to really, I don't know. Yeah, how do you feel
yeah.
about it? Was it a success? And what?
I think so.
What qualifies it as a success?
Yeah, what qualifies it as a success? I think several factors. One would be the number of people that were interacted with on the ground. Another would be the amount of media coverage we were able to get, and much of it was quite positive and actually extensive, linking different aspects of the story. So I was really impressed with that. You know, there was a piece on CBC where they you know talked about the Michigan leak, and they also talked about Enbridge's history of leakages and explosions, and also spoke with representatives from coastal First Nations, and so I thought stories like that were really excellent, because it just gives a sense of the sometimes, you know, we focus on, you know, very kind of clear and concise messages, but the story is always much bigger. And so I think the coverage that resulted from the action really helped kind of unpack the story, mm-hmm. and bring it to a very wide audience.
Well, I have to say, I did read a CBC article posted on their website, and often with many protests and actions and demonstrations, it's just coverage of the actual action, but nothing about why people are there. And mm-hmm. I did notice that in a number of reports that there was, you know, half the story was dedicated to why Greenpeace activists were involved in the issue and were opposing whatever issue it was, in this case, the proposed Enbridge pipeline to Kitimat.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, that's great. Any other comments before I let you go?
Yeah, just a quick thing. So part of why we're there, too, is, as I mentioned earlier, is to ask the government to impose a permanent ban on tanker traffic along the BC coast, and so that involves the northern coast, but it also involves the south, because, as you know, many of your listeners probably know, there are tankers currently coming in and out of the Burrard Inlet and through a pipeline that ends in Burnaby, and that pipeline is also carrying tar sands oil, and there are a number of campaigns in Lower Mainland working to end that tanker traffic. And that's just something else that I'd like to mention. You know, there's a No Tanks campaign and also a No Tankers campaign that folks might want to check out or get involved with.
Great. So any future campaigns or things that you'll be, obviously you're not going to talk about what's being planned, but anything more publicly that you want to mention that you're up to?
Yeah, just that, you know, this was one action, but Greenpeace will be, you know, continuing on this campaign, and so it's not the end of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just look forward to seeing what unfolds, and I really hope that Enbridge, you know, got the message and it is looking into withdrawing their proposal.
Okay, well, Christine, thank you so much for coming up to our studios, CITR studios at UBC on this holiday. So again, much appreciated, and thanks again for sharing your comments on this action. Again, speaking to Christine LeClaire, she's an activist with Greenpeace based here in BC, and we were discussing the recent action at the Enbridge office in downtown Vancouver. You're listening to CITR News 101 on 101.9 FM, streaming online at citr.ca. You can find our podcasts at citr.ca as well. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we've got Groundwire, grassroots news from an alternative perspective, and it's produced by community and campus stations across Canada. So stay with us. That's coming up next.
I'm troubled by shapeless fears. Who can live in the modern world without catching his share of them? I hope I've landed on my feet this time.
Need a place to rent? Have a place for rent? AMS Rents Line can help. AMS Rents Line is an easy-to-operate, touch-tone, and web-based system that connects thousands of landlords with UBC students looking for off-campus housing. UBC students can search the ads for free or place a two-week posting for $5. To view current listings, visit www.amsrentsline.com.
Government and Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
And you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver. This is News 101. And to summarize, we had Christine LeClaire, an activist with Greenpeace based here in BC, talking about the Enbridge action. So you can find that, if you missed that and you're tuning in now, you can find that on our podcast. That'll be posted shortly after the show at citr.ca. Now we're going to move to Groundwire. It's grassroots news produced by campus and community radio stations across the country, and this edition of Groundwire focuses on Indigenous perspectives and First Nations resistance. This is News 101.
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News. This week, Groundwire comes to you from CKUT Radio in Montreal. I'm Lauren.
I'm Joel.
First, in national news.
July 24th marked a National Day of Action against Federal Minister of Citizenship, Multiculturalism, and Immigration, Jason Kenney. Under Kenney's leadership, Immigration Canada increased the number of people it deports and lessened the number of asylum seekers and sponsored family members it permits into the country. Kenney banned British PM George Galloway for entering Canada for his vocal opposition to the war in Afghanistan and the occupation of Palestine. He removed remarks about LGBTQ rights from Canada's citizenship guide, and, controversially, he pulled Canada out of the Durban World Conference on Racism. Over 8,000 people have joined the Facebook group called Canadians Calling for the Resignation of Jason Kenney.
From the East Coast, Groundwire has been following the story of toxic dumping in the Pictou Landing Boat Harbour First Nation in Nova Scotia. The Chief and Council of Pictou Landing First Nation have filed a notice to sue this month against the Nova Scotia provincial government for their negligence in their responsibility to clean up toxic waste in nearby Boat Harbour. The industrial wastewater treatment facility located at Boat Harbour, owned by Northern Pulp, has been dumping toxic influent into the lagoon since it began operating in 1967. In a letter dated December 2008, the provincial government of NDP, Darrell Dexter, acknowledged its own responsibility to clean up the mess in the Boat Harbour lagoon. In March of 2010, the province lent $75 million to Northern Pulp to help the company secure a wood supply for its pulp and paper mill, allowing it to continue operating. The Pictou Landing lawsuit will ask for an injunction to shut down the Boat Harbour treatment facility. The Chief and Council will be able to commence the lawsuit on August the 31st.
The Manitoba Court of Appeals has issued a roadblock for Métis to overcome along their road to the Supreme Court of Canada. In a departure from a 1990 Supreme Court of Canada decision, the court questioned the Manitoba Métis Federation's standing and its ability to address constitutional issues. Manitoba's highest court did, however, acknowledge the fiduciary relationship between the Crown and the Métis. It also asserted that Métis do in fact hold Aboriginal title, something an earlier judge disputed. The Manitoba Métis Federation president, David Chartrand, said, quote, "We are disappointed, but we were by no means defeated. Based on the history of lower court Aboriginal land-related decisions, we had expected this outcome. It was also understood that no matter who won, this was going to go to the Supreme Court." End quote. The Métis say that the federal government has not lived up to its end of the Manitoba Act, a Métis federal government treaty struck in 1870.
To the West Coast now, where the BC Civil Liberties Association believes that an RCMP investigation into a hate crime in the town of Lake Cowichan, BC is fatally flawed. Catherine Fisher from CGLY in Nelson has more details.
In March of this year, some person or persons spray-painted an anti-gay slur on the fence surrounding Lake Cowichan resident Bill Hansen's home. Hansen, who has a security camera installed on his property, believes that the camera captured the culprits on film. Individuals visible in the footage have been identified as an off-duty RCMP auxiliary officer and a Lake Cowichan town employee. The video footage shows the men in the vicinity of the fence, but sometimes they drop out of the picture and it is often unclear what they are up to. It is known that the pair were working at the time, and in possession of work-issued blue spray paint cans, which they were using to paint the town wellheads near the fence around the time of the tag's appearance. The offending tag on the fence was also done in blue spray paint. Hansen reported his suspicions about the men to the local RCMP, who promised to investigate the matter thoroughly. Samples of the paint used in the tag were sent to the lab for analysis, but the results are not expected to be released until December of this year. In spite of this delay, Corporal Darren Lagan of the Lake Cowichan RCMP reported in late May that the RCMP investigation has shown there is no evidence to link the two men in any way to this act of graffiti. The video evidence submitted by the victim in no way shows any criminal acts being committed by the town employees. The BC Civil Liberties Association has expressed concern about the due diligence of the Lake Cowichan RCMP investigating the incident involving one of their own members. The association considers the closing of the investigation to be premature, as material evidence important to the investigation has not yet been tested. The BCCLA also states that the RCMP has made public statements that the video of the allegedly involved individuals clearly shows that the Lake Cowichan employees did not commit any mischief to the property, even though much of the activity of the employees behind the fence is not visible in the video. The BC Civil Liberties Association is also concerned with a statement made by the incident's investigating officer to the complainant. The officer in question said that she believed that she did not need to verify Lake Couch and RCMP claims about the incident because they are police officers and they would not lie to her. Executive Director of the BCCLA, David Ebby, says that whether or not the Lake Cowichan staffers are to blame for the graffiti isn't the association's debate. Their complaint is with the flawed RCMP investigation which has followed it. BCCLA President Robert Holmes believes that a thorough and complete investigation and public report is required for the benefit of the accused, the accuser, and the public. This is Catherine Fisher reporting for GroundWire.
Last year, GroundWire reported the establishment of Lou's Pharmacy, an all-women's pharmacy located in Vancouver. This month, Lou's Pharmacy will close its doors. Frieda Worden from CJSF reports on a first in feminist pharmaceutical care in Canada.
1 year after it opened, Lou's, a pharmacy for women, is no more. The Vancouver Women's Health Collective, which created the pharmacy, still occupies the premises at 29 West Hastings Street on Vancouver's downtown east side. However, they found they were unable to raise enough money to keep the pharmacy open. A pharmacist is very expensive, said collective member Natalie Richards, and you have to keep it staffed a lot of hours. She said the collective had held fundraisers and that the customer base had been increasing each month, but not yet enough to support the social enterprise. Lou's Pharmacy had become a focus of transgender activists because of its women-only mission. After a series of meetings with some of the activists, the Vancouver Women's Health Collective decided to change its policy to include all self-identified women. They changed their policy, but they didn't issue a formal apology, said trans activist Jamie Lee Hamilton on June 19th. So, no one in the community will support them. Vancouver Women's Health Collective still offers nurse practitioner services and access to other women's health resources at the 29 West Hastings Street location. The collective is open to all self-identified women.
GroundWire will return after this break.
On the ground, in your community. GroundWire is a listener-supported project of the National Campus Community Radio Association. Support community radio news. Support GroundWire by donating now at ncra.ca.
Back to GroundWire Community Radio News, grassroots stories from coast to coast. Now time for our feature stories. This week we continue to bring you the voices of Indigenous resistance.
On Monday, July 13th, at approximately 7 p.m.,
oil from Canada's steamship line's vessel, the MV Richelieu, spilled into the St. Lawrence Seaway. The CSL press conference stated that the engine motor failed, causing the ship to be adrift in the middle of the seaway. Whilst floating, the freighter dropped its anchor, and at that time, a wind squall came from the St. Lawrence River, which forced the vessel into its own anchor. The impact punctured the hull of the MV Richelieu, which allowed for the oil to spill into the seaway. Stuart Mayo, a Wolf Clan representative from the Mohawk Traditional Council of Ganawage, does not buy the CSL version of what happened to the ship. He explains that due to the water levels of the seaway, the weight of the vessel, and the position of the freighter vis-a-vis the St. Lawrence River, the MV Richelieu could not have collided that easily with its own anchor. Mayo suggests that the repairs done earlier to one of the fuel injectors may have been at the root of the problem.
So for us, when we look at it, we don't believe it. You know, number one, it's fine and dandy that they gave their official story, but the official story seems to have a lot of holes in it. We got to wonder if there's an investigation looking into the repairs that were done earlier that day.
What is also missing from the official story is the explanation of how the oil spilled into the St. Lawrence River. The Eastern Canada Response Corporation, the environmental specialist hired by the CSL to clean the waterway, was not yet finished with clearing the oil from the rocks and the surrounding coastline when the seaway locks were opened, allowing ships to enter and leave, and simultaneously permitting the oil spill to expand from the contained area of the seaway to the river.
The respective agencies responsible for opening those locks have totally disregarded the health and welfare of not only the people, but also of our Mother Earth and her waterways. But what we say is the reason why they opened those locks is that they were acting on pressure to get the ships that were waiting to come in before this strike occurred with the longshoremen. So it seems like this is what they've done to accommodate economic interests. The health and welfare of the people have been compromised. So that's why we say this is criminal. Whoever decided to open up those locks before the cleanup was done, that person, that agency, they should be held criminally responsible for this.
For Groundwire, this is Natalia Avdakimova, reporting from CKUT in Montreal.
One of the most controversial mines in Canadian history is under review in British Columbia. Last April, two Victoria-based independent journalists traveled to Williams Lake and a remote Chilcotin community in the Nemanja Valley to gain a better understanding of how residents feel about Prosperity Mine. They found a community that is grappling with a difficult question. Who gets to determine whether a mining boom is worth a potential bust? This is part two of Losing Ground.
Taseko Mine's proposed Prosperity Mine would be located 800 kilometers northwest of Vancouver near the city of Williams Lake. It's one of the most contentious mine proposals in Canadian history. Taseko's plan to convert nearby Fish Lake into a dump site for the mine's toxic waste is enabled by Schedule 2, an amendment to the Fisheries Act which allows mining corporations to use certain freshwater lakes across Canada as tailings impoundment areas. The Tsilhqot'in First Nation have been at the forefront of the opposition to the mine, but Prosperity Mine has found support in nearby Williams Lake, a resource-based city facing rising poverty. We traveled to the city of Williams Lake and the nearby First Nations community of Namaya Valley, two communities at the epicenter of the debate, to find out how the cost and benefits of mining are calculated in such a complex and contested case.
They're going to dispose of their mine waste and tailings into a dammed up portion of the lake as fish compensation for taking Fish Lake. They're going to create a new lake called Prosperity Lake.
Chief Joe Alphonse, Glencoe Government Office and M Indian Reserve. Fish Lake Talton B, it's very near and dear to the heart of all Chilcotin people. A lot of our members used to go into that area for ceremonial purposes, for spiritual purposes. When young people would be coming of age, they would seek to have a vision. Often that was one of the locations they were brought to, and that's where they would get their rite of passage. It's also a ceremonial site. There's burial grounds there, there's cremation site. Before European contact, we didn't bury our people. We cremated them. You know, on a rainy day or whatever, you see white flakes around. Now, those are generally remains of our ancestors. So that area specifically it's very sacred to our people. You got out a nation and you take their spirituality away. A lot of our families will make $8,000 to $10,000 a year, and that's it. And they're able to do that because they can go down to the rivers and still be able to pull fish out of the waters. When we look at our backyard there, you look at our rivers, you look at our fish, you're looking at our refrigerator system. That's where we store our food, and that's what we need to continue to do. You have the last large wild sockeye salmon run left, and you're on the verge, on the cusp of destroying that. You know, scientists all over the world are constantly warning about this type of things, and we have to change our behavior. We have to start looking after the environment. At some point, the environment will quit looking after us.
Why did you decide to do a presentation today?
Because this is our lives. Because we don't want fish lake poisoned.
Fish lake is important to us.
The earth is better, more better than gold.
Water is going to save us and gold will not. It only gives us jobs.
Find gold up your nose.
The voices you've been listening to were recorded over the course of 4 days in the Maya Valley. The mine is creating a fracture across the region. The city of Williams Lake, located 100 kilometers down a gravel road east of Namaya Valley, has been hard hit by the pine beetle and declining softwood lumber markets. The idea of a mine-induced job bonanza is welcomed by many, but the story is not as cut and dry as it seems. Williams Lake Mayor Carrie Cook explains.
Williams Lake is the hub of the Cariboo. We are primarily resource-based community. We are dependent on forestry, mining, ranching. We have a population of about 11,000 people. We know we have to diversify. We're looking at, you know, an integrated approach to long-term planning and doing a number of things differently. But when people are hurting at the level that they're hurting, and I'll just give you some stats, you know, with our local food bank, it has seen increases of 300%. We've seen increases of 500 to 600% with new families accessing, you know, our food social network. This is costing our local community almost $30,000 a month. We're not naive to think that prosperity is going to solve all of our problems in Williams Lake. That would be like saying that money buys happiness. And so I certainly don't believe that.
Have they given you concrete numbers?
No, we don't have those concrete numbers. So what we're doing is, again, building a relationship and trying to ensure that our voice is heard and our concerns are heard.
I'm Walter Cobb. I'm actually the Vice President of the Chamber of Commerce. I'm a private business person here in Williams Lake and have been in business since 1969. We're in dire straits here. There are many, many businesses that are hurting, and there's a lot of people that are unemployed, and we need to get them back working. We need some sort of economic development. If we don't have it, it will be pretty grim, because we're looking at the downfall period of our forest industry because of the pine beetle. We're probably going to see a couple of mills close, more unemployment. So it looks pretty bleak.
Excuse me, can we ask you a couple of questions about the Prosperity Mine?
I haven't really heard the full story on it, but according to the latest studies, they say that that lake will not be in any way harmed, or the watersheds. And as far as Fish Lake is concerned, the natives do not use it anyway. The reason I'm for it is because we need the industry here in Williams Lake with a downturn of the lumber industry. And there's no reason why it should not go ahead.
It's only the people that are going to profit from it financially that want it. The guys that are driving the big shiny red pickups and got to pay for them somehow. I've been here a lot of years, and Williams Lake is resilient. It always comes back. We're not opening mines every day and ruining the countryside, polluting the water and screwing up, you know? Sure, we could use some more jobs, but it's not the most important thing in the world.
Back at the hearings in the Maya Valley, we wondered how the governments of Canada and of BC can even consider mega projects like Prosperity without meaningful consultation of the Tsilhqot'in. We found that this question is couched in the much bigger issue of First Nations rights and title in Canada. According to the latest court rulings, the Heniquatin have 50% of the title and 100% of hunting and trapping rights in the 4,400 square kilometer area. But the issue of title is currently under appeal in the courts, and in the meantime,
the Tsokoltin are in a tough spot trying to make the case to protect their lands.
My name is Roger William. Right now I've been working as a Tsokoltin Land and Stewardship Director. I learned English in the residential school. You know, we've been in a title case for 20 years. Fish Lake right now is not in a proven title area, but it's inside our declaration of rights to hunt, to trap, to trade, and also to catch and use wild horses. BC or Canada can approve a project, whether it's title or rights, declaration or proven, for the betterment of the country. So now, if you don't have no proven rights or title, they can provide opportunities. There's different agreements that you can use. But if you have title and you have rights, that damage has to be paid for any First Nations.
My name is Ivor Myers, Chief of Yonasiting Government. The Tsokoltin Nation, the people themselves, have the final say, not the federal government.
But for the moment, the federal government does seem to have the final say. One of the primary critiques of environmental assessment processes in Canada is the way in which they impose colonial decision-making processes on First Nations communities. Chief Marilyn Baptiste explains.
This process is foreign to our people. Our people do not agree that we should have to prove that this is our home, that this land, the water, and the animals should be protected. We shouldn't have to prove that.
I'm Margaret Lulua. I work with the Tsokoltin National Government. Within my job, I've dealt with a lot of different engagement requests that have been made within our traditional territories. The companies come in, we give them our views, but it doesn't really matter. To them, that's consultation. They can take it, but they don't have to use it.
We know this area, we know how to look after it, so to come in and drill a hole for the benefit of a few years, what's 20 years? It's devastating, we don't want to take that risk.
For my children and the people of Huntingwood-Ean and for sustainability, I would stand up and won't let them in.
I do not think this mine will go through. Our people have always stood up and protected our territory, and we're continuing that legacy carried on from our forefathers, and we will continue.
What if this is your backyard? What if this lake had your history and your connection? And I just want to let people in BC and Canada know, if they can make this pristine lake that we still use today, we have historical sites, we have special connection to it, and we have ceremonial, spiritual process still happening every year, and it's going to be gone for a 20-year mining life for the money, for gold, for copper. What if this was your backyard? What do you feel? Do you agree with this?
This documentary was recorded in Namaya Valley and Williams Lake in British Columbia. The voices we heard are among the people who testified in the Federal Environmental Assessment Panel review of Taseko Mine's controversial Prosperity Mine project. For more information, point your browser to www.savefishlake.ca.
That was part two in a two-part documentary called Losing Ground, The Struggle for Tizan Binny Fish Lake. Thanks to producer Tamara Herman and Susie Porter-Bopp for that report.
And now, an exclusive interview from Voice Prince Contact Program. Miss Wesley Eskimo discusses the origin of the residential schools and her own family's experience with the school. She looks at the perception of the schools and how First Nation peoples were seen as second-class citizens. Miss Wesley Eskimo is an assistant professor of Aboriginal Studies at the University of Toronto.
Eventually it became law that they had to send these children to school.
And in this, the residential school setting, their traditions, their religion, everything was removed.
Oh, it was villainized, absolutely. They were told that their parents were heathens and that their religions were improper, they were evil, and they were told a lot of different kinds of things in order to get them to conform. So that was really the most damaging piece of the whole thing. They did learn to read and write, and, you know, my mother went to residential school for 8 years, and, you know, she says, I benefit from the fact that I learned how to do all those things, and I got a good work ethic, and all those pieces. However, I didn't grow up with my mother, and I lost some of those connections with my family that I would have had if I'd been able to stay home.
But it was very important that there be no native expression. Correct?
Oh, not in the schools, no. But, of course, people still maintained it in the communities and on the reserves. They were able to take it underground and actually retain it. And I think that's been one of the saving graces in today's society is that Aboriginal peoples did that. And we have a lot of elders, we have elders out there that have been able to retain those languages and cultures, ceremonialism, and are reteaching it to people. I mean, even I go to school now with an elder, and I'm 51. So, I mean, we're all trying very hard to get that back so that we can continue to pass it down to our children and grandchildren.
You mentioned about your mum being in a residential school system. What did you learn about that growing up?
Well, I learned that there was something terribly wrong with the community in which I was born into because there was so much violence and there was a lot of alcoholism in the communities. And a lot of the people that I grew up with were in the city. I grew up in Toronto, had come from residential schools all over the place. And so there was a lot of acting out. And I really didn't understand that because I grew up in Toronto, I also went to other people's homes and I didn't see the same kinds of things happening there that I saw in my household. So for me, that was a real big question in my mind. What happened? And why is it that people behave this way? And it set me on a path to learning about those kinds of experiences that they had. And I was almost sent to residential school myself when I was about 14. And that's about the time the school that she went to closed.
I see.
So I sort of got a reprieve there. But there was certainly a move to try to... children weren't sent to school. You know, there was a lot of stuff going on in our communities. It's still going on to a certain extent, even though we've come a long way, that broke families apart quite early on.
Eskimo is an assistant professor of Aboriginal Studies at the University of Toronto. That interview was provided to Grant Ryer, courtesy of VoicePrint. To hear this interview in its entirety, please visit their website at voiceprintcanada.com or call VoicePrint at 1-800-567-6755, extension 226.
And now it's time for the Community Radio Report. This week, the Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission, the CRTC, released a decision that will provide stable funding for community radio in Canada for the very first time. More than $750,000 each year will go towards the Community Radio Fund of Canada to help support stations. The money was part of a larger policy that governs the sector. Groundwire spoke with the three groups representing community radio in Canada. Here's Shelley Robinson of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, Martin Bougie, Executive Director of the Association des Radiodiffuseurs Communautaires du Québec, and François Côté, Executive Director of Alliance des Radios Communautaires du Canada.
My name is Shelley Robinson, and I'm the Executive Director of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. There's a number of new and encouraging things that the CRTC just released in their update to the Campus and Community Radio Policy. The big one that lots of people are talking about is the fact that the sector has got money for the first time. The Community Radio Fund of Canada is now eligible, and it will, in fact, be mandated to get a certain percentage of the Canadian Content Development Contributions. So it's going to equal over $700,000 a year. So that's huge. Internally, sort of within community radio stations, there's also some other big changes that happen. So, for instance, we always used to be defined as an alternative to the commercial and the public radio broadcasting sector, and now we don't have that same sense of being defined by what we're not, but they defined us more positively as what we are, which is by virtue of our structure, so non-profit, public access, driven by volunteers for the most part. So that was also a really great thing. But there are some other things that we as a sector asked for. So, for instance, we asked for spectrum to be reserved for community stations in communities that don't already have a station. The CRTC came back and said, well, we're not the right ones to do that. That's the governor and council. So for as to what's next is we're going to be taking that request to the governor and council.
I'm François Côté. I'm Secretary General of Alliance des Radios Communautaires du Canada. We decided that the three big associations of community radios in Canada should work together toward the new policy for community radio on campus. We did a very, very good job in front of the CRTC. The first big success for us would be financing. The fact that the CRTC recognized that our sector was underfunded was the biggest news of the new policy.
Martin Bougie, Executive Manager from Quebec Community Radio Association. it just made sense for us to sit at the same table and speak one voice for the whole sector. We all sit in markets where it's hard to just finance the mission, and this mission has a cost. When you want to provide good local services, local information and such, well, this has a cost. I think it's worth mentioning, too, that there is a little line in the definition that just says that community campus radio is a guaranteed local radio service. And this is very important. Citizens all over the country are seeing their local service just getting out. They really have to rely on local media, such as community and campus radio. So we really stand as one sector now. I would have just one message to send to all stations across Canada is just get involved in the fund. This is a very historic time, and the fund relies on its members to take decisions and everything.
One thing that I've learned the last couple of years is it's so important to be present at CRTC's hearing every time. So we need to be more present at those hearing to let the CRTC knows, hey, we do care and we are here and it's important to us.
The CRTC has done their bit and now it's our time to sort of stand up and keep it going. We want to build on our momentum.
That's all from Grand Rire Community Radio News this week. We thank headline producer David Parker, Jabba Loren, Omer Raem Toula and Freda Redden. Production was done by CKUT in Montreal. Thanks for listening. I've been your host, Lorraine Sénéchal, and
Joel Bard. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association and airs on over 30 community radio stations across Canada. All our episodes are available for podcasting at groundwire.ncra.ca. For their support, Groundwire thanks the Public Service Alliance of Canada. Think public and visit psac.com for more information. We also thank the Canadian Union of Public Employees. See qp.ca for details.
And thanks to Groundwire for that latest edition produced by CKUT in Montreal. And that's our program for August 2nd, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news at citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITR News. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Andrew Longhurst from the entire news team at CITR. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Career Fast Track right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.